Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Helen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, I'm Daniel Tancredi, and I'm delighted to welcome Distinguished Professor Ebrin Meyer to our podcast today. Ebrin is the executive director of the Oppenheimer Family Center for Neurobiology of Stress and co-director of the CURE Digestive Disease Research Center at UCLA. But that doesn't begin to describe the major contributions he's made in helping us understand the role of the gut and the mind in our overall health. He's an author of several books, including a bestseller, The Mind-Gut Connection, How the Hidden Conversation Within Our Bodies Impacts Our Mood, Our Choices, and Our Overall Health. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Meyer here today and have him first kind of give us a little bit of an overview of the communication between the mind and the gut.
Yeah, thanks, Dan, for the kind introduction. And thanks to ISAP for inviting me to this podcast. It's a real pleasure to do that. Yeah, I think the communication between two systems that don't seem to have much in common at first glance, the microbes living in the oxygen-free darkness of our gut and our supercomputer in our heads that, you know, is unparalleled, at least until now, in terms of computational abilities. So how, I mean, first of all, why would these two systems be connected, and how do they connect with each other? So the reason that they are connected has to do with evolution, that microbes have been around in the oceans of planet Earth for billions of years, and they had a lot of time to perfect their communication system with each other, but also their ability to get nutrients from a world that initially didn't have any animals in it, not even plants. So they had a lot of time and were able to store a lot of information in terms of molecules, metabolism in their genes. And, you know, there's hundreds of millions of genes that these microorganisms have assembled. And at some point in evolution, there was probably by coincidence that some microbes got inside the digestive tube of one of most primitive marine animals, and that turned out to be really advantageous for this marine animal called the hydra. And that animal had some unique features. One is it was a floating digestive tube with a nerve net wrapped around it, with an opening on both ends. And this nerve net, if you look at a micrograph of it today and compare it to a micrograph of our enteric nervous system in the gut, it looks almost identical. So the origin of our enteric nervous system from these primitive marine animals is clearly something that has been, it's turned out to be very advantageous for animals, and we humans still have an enteric nervous system, which is really important. Now, these microbes have been able to not just only live inside these digestive tubes, but also probably by lateral gene transferred some of these genes, of these millions of genes that they have accumulated, to the nerve cells of this floating digestive tube. And that's for the origin of our neurotransmitters, which first were in the enteric nervous system, but then later with the development of heads of animals, so development of polar animals, would transfer to the brain as well. So we have a shared communication system or alphabet that goes from the microbes to the enteric nervous system of the hydra to the brains of more advanced animals. So this is for the main reason why this communication is even possible. They share, these unlikely systems share a communication code that's very similar, and homologs, you know, of neurotransmitters are found in certain microbes And that communication has been expanded. So today we know that many microbes living in our gut produce molecules by metabolizing nutrients like tryptophan, for example, generating tryptophan and other, you know, tryptophan metabolites, all of which have neuroactive abilities. At the same time, the brain is able to communicate with the microbes in the gut as well, because when we are under stress or with, you know, negative emotions, we activate our sympathetic nervous system, and these neurotransmitters that come from the, from that stress system not only influence the environment in which the microbes live in, but changing transit rates and motility, but also they can influence the gene expression in certain microbes as well and change the behavior of the microbes. So when we are stressed, anxious, depressed, the microbes will know it and will change their behaviors in ways that we currently don't completely understand, you know, what role this plays. And in my book, I made some speculation that there's these circular loops that emotions that start in the gut affect the microbes. The microbes then produce metabolites, feed back to the brain, and the long-lasting nature of emotions may have to do with these circular loops that are created within the brain and the microbes. So a long story, but in some ways it's fascinating to look back how this communication developed and why it's so important for us today. Is this has existed longer than most other biological blueprints that have not turned out to be as advantageous for the survival of the species than this particular component.
That's very interesting. I should let the listeners know that you're a gastroenterologist. Can you talk a little bit about how the understanding of the GI tract has kind of evolved to be more sophisticated? It's no longer this thought of as this mechanical process. It's now we have a much more refined understanding of the back and forth between the microbes and other molecules between the brain and the gut. A lot of that thanks to your own research.
Yeah, so my initial interest in as a gastroenterologist was really in the enteric nervous system and how that regulates motility in the gut. But then I realized at the time fairly quickly that the motility is just one aspect of it. You know, the enteric nervous system regulates basically all gut functions from secretion to blood flow to regional transits and different patterns during vomiting, diarrhea, and constipation. But the most interesting thing that I found at the time in my early phases of the career, working at the Cure Institute at UCLA, that the same molecules that are present in the enteric nervous system were also now found in the brain. So in the gut, we call them gut peptides. In the brain, they were called neuropeptides. And then at some point, somebody from the NIH sent us supernatant from a culture of E. coli and asked us, because at the time, using radium immunoassays to detect these signaling molecules, asked us to see if we could detect any of these signaling molecules in these E. coli supernatants. And we did. So that introduced the microbes as another source of the same molecules. And in the meantime, we know that the gut is not just a simple mechanical tube that transports things from, you know, from the esophagus to the anus. And it's also not just a storage device for waste material, you know, in our stool. But the term gut connectome has been proposed to describe what we understand today. That basically refers to the fact that the gut is the location for the biggest part of our immune system. At least 50% of our immune system is located in the gut, between the layers of the gut. It's also the seat of, you know, 100 million nerve cells, making up the enteric nervous system. It's also the seat of a very complex hormonal system, like all our satiety hormones that, you know, make us stop eating when we had a satiating meal. And all these systems in the gut are connected with each other, none functions in isolation. So the best way to understand what's going on there is really this bidirectional interactions between gut-based immune system, gut-based hormonal system, the enteric nervous system, and then there's other cells as well, epithelial cells that play a role in this communication. So it's the gut all of a sudden has become one of the most sophisticated organs in the body, particularly with the immune system, the gut-based immune system sitting there at the interface with the microbes and the enteric nervous system and food coming into the gut, now you have this connection that food can have an influence on our immune system and has been shown to play a major role in this problem that we have today with chronic non-contagious diseases. We're living in an epidemic of including, you know, ischemic heart disease, colon cancer, Alzheimer's disease. All these have sort of at the basis this inappropriate engagement of the immune system, which starts in the gut, and with diet having a major influence on the activity of this immune system. It's a sort of an engineering miracle that evolution has come up with, that our immune system is microns away from these microbes that live inside the gut, trillions of them. And so anything that influences the microbes, particularly diet and also top-down factors from the brain, can change the microbial behavior and how they interact with the immune system. So all of a sudden, we have sort of a blueprint of how the chronic diseases that we're actually pretty good in keeping people alive with these chronic diseases. So with heart disease, you know, we can do bypass surgery, we can do all kinds of medications. But the root cause of it, you know, which in my opinion starts in the gut, we've not really come up with good answers, because it's the complexity, how these multiple systems interact with each other has not really been appreciated, and, you know, has not really been identified. How would you influence such a complex system? You know, we're still in the mindset we want to identify one receptor on one cell type and develop a drug targeted at this one receptor, but that's not going to deal with these complexities that I described to you of the gut connectome. And to me, it's interesting that all of a sudden, when I started my career, I mean, there were not many people interested in gut health. That term didn't even exist, quite honestly. So gut health at that time was the absence of serious gut diseases like inflammatory bowel disease or colon cancer. So today, gut health has become like this ubiquitous term that describes anything from well-being, feeling good, which reflects really more this complexity that I described to you, that the gut has an influence on all these other systems, from the mind to the immune system to your heart to the digestive function.
So can you talk a little bit about the evidence we have for the associations of gut health with brain health and how they may differ with regard to neurodevelopmental and psychiatric disorders and the commonalities?
Yeah, that science really started with really provoking animal experiments, mainly coming out of the University College of Cork in Ireland and John Cryan experiments, where they manipulated the gut microbiome and found changes in the behavior of animals, emotion-like behavior of animals. And all of a sudden, there was a new field, you know, within psychiatry, that psychiatric diseases like depression and anxiety, and then this was carried even further with animal models to autism spectrum, and then these neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And I would have to say, still today, you know, most convincing evidence for a causal relationship between what goes on in the gut and what goes on in the brain and these human diseases is still based on these animal models. It's been a real challenge to actually translate this into, you know, evidence-based, actionable consequences that you could treat any of these mental disorders with changing the gut microbes or particular organisms. But I think the evidence from animals is too strong to ignore this. And I think we have to look at, why has it been so difficult to translate it? Is it the heterogeneity of humans, the multifactorial cause of depression and anxiety? It's not like in an animal where you change one variable, the animals are all identical, you change one variable and you get a disease. That's just not how these brain diseases, you know, develop in humans. I mean, there's some interactions of So, you know, I would say today it's an exciting time to solve this puzzle. How can we go from the animal findings and to successful interventions in animals to having novel treatments in humans?
Yes. Now, not just with brain health, but just the whole range of chronic non-communicable diseases, you've noted that microbiome-targeted dietary interventions are some of the most effective treatments for some of those. Do you think that that's purely immunological, like you're improving the gut health, and because of that's influences on inflammation and immunological influences, that that's how we're getting the benefits? Or do you think there's maybe other things going on?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, nothing in this system is straightforward and simple. So there's always complexity. I mean, with our diet, there's obviously all kinds of health beneficial components, from vitamins to, you know, trace minerals to macronutrients and micronutrients. And but one thing that has evolved is sort of a, and it may be oversimplified, but it, right now it fits the data pretty well, that our standard American diet, which is basically deficient, largely deficient in fiber and other plant-derived beneficial molecules like polyphenols, that diet has changed the gut microbes in a way that the production and the maintenance of a tight barrier, epithelial barrier, between the lumen of the gut with the microbes in it and the immune system has been compromised. And now, even without, so a lot of people think, you know, leaky gut is means like holes in your gut where microbes get into your bloodstream. I mean, that's not how it works. It's just that the contact of beneficial microbes with sensors of parts of the immune system, dendritic cells, that that's enough to stimulate the immune system in the gut to a low-grade inflammation. That information can then change the tight junctions between the epithelial layer, making the gut actually more permeable. And then ultimately, this inflammatory response doesn't stay in the gut, but it gets into the systemic circulation, reaches all organs. Dendritic cells can migrate to other organs like the liver, fat tissue. So all these other organs then become also inflammatory generators. You know, the fat tissue becomes, and ultimately these inflammatory changes can reach the brain. And a big part of the immune system is also in the brain. The glial cells, making up 40% of the cells in the brain, are stimulated to produce cytokines, which then affect neurotransmission. So that link between diet and affecting the role of microbes in maintaining a tight barrier between the microbes and the immune system is probably one of the core problems that lies at the basis of all these chronic non-communicable diseases. You know,
yes,
there may be vitamin deficiencies and mineral deficiencies, but I think that has evolved as one of the main mechanisms.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned glial cells. We need to learn a lot more about them as well as what's going on in the gut. On a personal note, Dr. Mayer, I wonder about your own journey growing up as the son of candy makers in Bavaria and ending up in Southern California. How has your own diet changed in your taste for different kinds of foods? Has it become more diverse or less?
Yeah, no, so it's interesting. So, you know, growing up in the business of my parents and working there actually, you know, to make money when I was going to school and university, I consumed a lot of sugary things. But at the same time, you know, overall the diet was actually, now looking back, was quite healthy. Consumption of a lot of fermented foods was a natural part of it. Relatively limited intake of consumption of red meat, you know, once a week. Regular consumption of fish once a week. So there were a lot of things, now I look back, and actually it wasn't that unhealthy. Yeah, the sugar was bad, but, and there also was a lot of exercise that we did living in this mountain town, you know. But the biggest change and the biggest awareness of the importance of diet really happened when I wrote my first book and then, you know, got onto all these podcasts and internet. And it's really changed dramatically, you know, with the goal to have an intake of a minimum of 15 to 20 different types of fruits and vegetables a week. Sometimes we reach that on one day, these numbers, you know, with combined the breakfast bowl with nuts and seeds and different berries and fruits to the dinner with a salad that has 15 components. So this is something, it's kind of amazing how we have evolved with my interest in this my scientific interest in this area. And
yes. When you refer to your first book, do you mean your first scientific book, the one on basic and clinical aspects of chronic abdominal pain?
No, it was the Mind-Gut Connection. So
yes, the bestseller.
You know, until that, I was not that focus on diet, really. It was not something, as a gastroenterologist at the time, this was not something you learned or it was emphasized, even for many diseases. You know, it's just recent, for example, that the interest of the inflammatory bowel community, research community in diet, you know, started. It was just, I still remember a few years ago, being involved in generating the first white paper for the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, which had environmental triggers in it. One was diet and the other one was stress. But this was only 5 years ago, four years ago. So it's
I think that's a legacy of our mechanistic approach. I mean, our mechanical views of how organ systems work and our lack of appreciation for some of these interplays that you're helping us get a better understanding of.
And now today what's happening is, I see it at UCLA and other places. So rather than the physicians or the gastroenterologists becoming the experts in the diet aspect, they hire dietitians and create a subset within the division of dietitians that, you know, promote their own insights, which are not always based on the latest science. You know,
so yeah, that's a problem too. I just wish that, given that there's relatively lower harm associated with dietary interventions, or there can be, than there are with, you know, cutting vagus nerves or, you know, modifying, you know, the release of key hormones and things with pharmacological treatments, that people would try to pursue potentially effective treatments that have low toxicity.
Yeah, the vagus nerve, good example. You know, in my early research work at UCLA, we studied these patients, peptic ulcer disease patients, after different types of vagotomies. And yeah, it did work to prevent ulcer recurrence, but the side effects of some of these surgeries were amazing. And we had no idea why. You know, we had no idea that you cut the communication system with the microbes and the brain, you know. And
yeah,
people developed all kinds of strange symptoms that we couldn't explain at the time. But the surgeons didn't care. They would say, okay, your ulcer is healed, but nobody paid attention to these other symptoms.
So you really witnessed, you know, a real dramatic, you basically were there at a paradigm shift in science. What makes you excited about the future in the work in the field you're working on and just in science in general?
Yeah, so I think we're just at the beginning, really, of what microbiome science can teach us and how it will influence. I mean, right now, you know, the consequence of a lot of the clinical consequences, eat more yogurt, eat more of, you know, probiotics. But that's just a very simple way of,
right.
I think ultimately when we understand the system better, there's going to be much more sophisticated and personalized interventions that will be possible. I think what makes me excited the most is that paradigm shift from the kind of science and medicine that I grew up in, which was this, you know, receptor-targeted, reductionistic approach to I hate to use the word holistic, but systems biological approach to disease and understanding disease and treating disease. And obviously diet will play a major role in this for the future. I think we're at the beginning of this massive paradigm shift in understanding complex biological systems and diseases. You know, and it's very different. It's, if you're a cardiovascular surgeon, you create a bypass surgery, works really well. If you want to understand why this person developed coronary disease in the first place, I mean, you now have to take into account the immune system and the gut microbes and the metabolites that produce. It's a much more complex system. And I think our medical approaches lag way behind, for example, what the surgeons can do, you know, in a two-hour surgery.
Yes. Well, you also have a deep appreciation for One Health and the fact that it's not just the systems within the individual patient, but the patient is part of a larger community. And there's microbiotic considerations across lots of different scales and lots of different animals, and animal health and matters for human health and vice versa.
Yeah, this is another thing I find absolutely fascinating, how the microbial composition of our soil, what big role this plays in the health of the plants and the health benefits for us when we eat these plants. It's not just eating any plant. It's a plant that has grown up in a healthy soil microbial ecosystem that we want to consume and that is good for us. That's another fascinating aspect, that we cannot sort of separate human health from health of the environment and health of the planet. If you get into this, you know, and I'm not sure how many people are doing it the way I do it, it sort of becomes just like a total eye-opener how all these problems that we're facing now in modern life are interconnected, you know,
yes.
From climate change to pollution of the oceans. So it's all part of the same. And that will require a major paradigm shift on all levels, I think, to solve this.
Yes. Well, I appreciate the work you're making in helping us kind of come up with better solutions for the health of all of us, not just the humans. So it's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Professor Mayer. And I'd like to let you have the last word.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for the opportunity. Every time I can get this message out to the public beyond my scientific and medical colleagues, I really appreciate that, because often I think that a lot of people in the lay public are more aware and more receptive. In medicine, unless it's in a textbook, you know, people don't really believe it, or it's published in Nature or Science. I think the lay public is more receptive to these concepts of interconnectedness, because they feel it, they experience it. And so my main goal at this point of my career is really to do this big teaching effort, reaching a large as possible audience with this message over and over again. And I can see it amongst a lot of the students that, you know, have worked with me. I mean, they're very receptive to this message. You know, once they go to the medical school, you know, the 4 years of medical school, obviously many of them will become the same reductionistic minds, but many of them will not, you know, and really pursue a different career based on these concepts of interconnectedness.
Thank you. That's perfect.